This is Catherine Murphy interviewing Dr. Claire Haugen from Concordia College for the Heritage Education Commission Oral History Project. Dr. Haugen has been and is very closely related to the development of the theater program at Concordia College. Claire, could we begin with just some early biographical material? From where did you come?
Me?
Oh. Yes.
Fulton Township in Otter Tail County, on a farm between Henning and Vining.
Oh. Now,
so that makes it lengthy. When someone asks where
yes,
I was born, I
okay.
have to fill all that
all
stuff
right.
in. Yeah.
Somehow I had assumed you came out of North Dakota. I don't know why.
No.
But you are a Minnesota,
well, I have a rural
Minnesotan
look to me. Yeah.
Born and bred.
Yeah.
Good.
And not too far from here, actually.
Fine. How did you develop an interest in theater?
I suppose it's connected with my personality in some way. I think most of us, and you might be able to vouch for that yourself, who are attracted to theater, find audience response a supportive thing, and the possibility of developing alter ego characters in a socially approved way. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's really an extension to the kind of child's play that we all indulge in.
Did you have a particular teacher in early years who encouraged participation in speech and theater activities?
There were two people, one in high school and one in college. I don't think I thought of theater as a field, you know, as something to mm-hmm. do more than mm-hmm. as a hobby until I got to college. And in college, a man was named Donald Spencer, and we'll probably talk more about him later on. But I can remember his suggesting to me once that if I were interested in continuing in theater in some respect, and at that time the idea was if you're interested in theater, then you go to graduate school, and then you get a job at a college or university. You know?
Right.
And that he would not hesitate to recommend that to me. I would not hesitate to. It's kind of a phrase that stuck in my mind. And I thought, that sounds interesting. You know, mm-hmm. I can continue doing something that I like to do mm-hmm. and possibly even get paid for it. And remember, this is about 1955 when one could get jobs. You know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that was an important point for me to think about theater seriously and not just another student hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been interested in music, and I'd sung, I'd played several musical instruments, and I've been interested in school journalism, and when I went to college, I was going to be a student. Right? I wasn't going to do any of this extracurricular stuff. Well, I found out that I simply had more spare time. I wasn't any better student. And theater was a really absorbing kind of thing. I believe it gave me sort of stimulation and motivation, a place to do things and accomplish things that I did not in more channeled kinds of activities. To be honest, I think most colleges, like Concordia, were not so rigorous in the 1950s as they are now. And students who had an ability to catch on to things quickly, and I was that kind of a lucky person, had a lot of spare time,
mm-hmm.
and theater was there to fill it in. In fact, I think I hit a point where I went to school in my spare time.
I identify with that. I think that's
those are good years.
A good description.
Yeah.
And so it appeals not only to an imaginative participation, but theater is a social
and
relationship
it, yes.
also
yes.
because it's a group activity.
Really multidimensional. The people that you meet and that you work with, some people that I don't see anymore, really, but I think about every day and more or less keep in touch with, mm-hmm. they're dear, good people.
Mm-hmm.
And the intellectual challenge, too, because understanding the literature, speculating on meanings,
right.
the whole task of criticism, interpretation, leading to theory, and theater history and all kinds of other things, I found tremendously stimulating,
right.
and still do.
It kind of gets to you in spite of yourself. I think it's a wonderful way to work with students in interpretation,
yeah.
particularly. literature.
I think I started out with a kind of a suspicion, a good Fulton Township Lutheran Free Church suspicion of the performing arts, because, well, that's pretend, you know, and you don't make things with your hands, at least I didn't think so, and it was self-indulgent. And the hours were probably immoral, you know, too late in the morning and too late at night.
Sure.
And so I needed to overcome those kinds of things. By the way, another dimension of theater that I discovered was just the craft dimension. And I learned how to use carpentry tools in the theater and soldering irons and all kinds of stuff. And I gained, I'm good at that stuff now. And I gained a dimension in my life and a self-respect that... like lots of 19-year-olds, you know, you need.
Yeah, that's interesting. You didn't bring that with you when you arrived. You learned it through all the crew and construction work.
And patient people who said, no, not that way, do it again.
Do it again. Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. The years, your years of being a student at Concordia were what years?
Autumn 1953 to spring 1957.
Okay. And from there, where did you...
I did a quickie, two semesters master's at the University of Wisconsin. I had enlisted in the Army Reserve at about the same point I enrolled in college. And the Korean War was going, and I felt remiss because people I knew were serving. And the Minnesota 47th Infantry Division had been called up to active duty. And there were some people I knew who had opted to leave school even to go active with the unit. And so there was a lot of do your part kind of feeling on, and I felt that very strongly. I think I still do. So I enlisted in the Army Reserve. That was an 8-year hitch.
Oh boy!
And but one of the things that it did for me is that it gave me exemption from active military service, and I didn't need to take a 2S student deferment. That was important to me.
Yes.
So my plan was, after I finished college, I was going to go active duty for 6 months. And go to some kinds of schools that related to my military occupation specialty, MOS. I was a counterfire specialist.
I see.
And, well, I sat around all summer being put off at two-week intervals until, after I graduated, until August, when I decided that the Army had had its chance at me, and I decided to go to graduate school. So I phoned my teacher and mentor, and he phoned some friends at the University of Wisconsin, and they came up with an assistantship. It seems so easy now, looking back at it. In the space of a few days, all this was arranged. And then, as I was packed and ready to go, then I got a job offer. If, when I came back, I wanted to teach at Concordia for a year to replace somebody who had resigned at effective that point, then I could do that. That was an exciting prospect, and I think I was overly impressed with the possibilities of going to work at Alma Mater, and ego received a considerable boost. Someone else I knew who ran a rival theater around here advised me against it, said it was a bad idea, and I should come talk to him when I came back with my degree. So I felt very good about it and very motivated, went off to graduate school, did a two semesters master's, and then came back to work. And then that's where I've been, with time off for good behavior from time to time, go off on leaves and things like that.
Right. What was the area of emphasis at the University of Wisconsin that attracted you there? Was there a specialty in theater that particularly intrigued you?
It was a generalist degree. But like so many people who go to graduate school, that was the only institution that I really visualized as a viable graduate institution. And I see that with so many students. You know, no matter how many places they look at, there's some place that they can identify as the place to go. In my case, it was because one of my teachers had been there, and he named names, and I could see what it would be like. when I went back to tackle my PhD, and that was a toughie because of the short masters, then I was more hard-headed about picking a graduate school, and I decided to go to the University of Iowa. The reason for deciding that was a man named Oscar G. Brockett, who's who still is a scholar in theater history, criticism, and theory, had a fine reputation, and I wanted to go study
particularly
around him.
With him.
Yeah. And but I spent a year, and then went back to the University of Wisconsin and finished my degree there. Oh. Stayed in the Big Ten, though. That's the main thing.
Good.
You're asking about specialty. I don't think I developed a notion of specialty until I had... I was trying to develop a dissertation area. And I had an ignoble reason for picking my dissertation area. I wanted to travel. And so I picked a topic that required leaving the country, and the University of Wisconsin had good support funds for travel grants. And I got one of those and went to England and studied 19th century theater innovation. And that has since developed into theater innovation in general, contemporary theater innovation. I still work on that research area. But that was something that really went back to my early years as an undergraduate at Concordia, because I was around people, one person in particular, Donald Spencer, who had a kind of reformer's zeal about doing things differently and doing them uniquely, and an intense pride and integrity on doing things his way. That extended to his students. Not that we were expected to do things his way, but we were expected to find our own way and do things our own way. And that gave me a respect and enthusiasm for innovative kinds of theater. And that has persisted all through. So I guess, although I didn't realize it at the time, the pattern behind everything I did was to seek a place where I could, develop as an innovative, creative theater person.
Well, that's very interesting to see the links and put them together, because I hadn't realized this chain of influences before.
I also turned into a theater historian, so I suppose I tend to find patterns where none exist, so you take that a grain of salt. But I think that happened.
Well, the purpose of this history project is to try to survey programs in the community of Moorhead. I think basically a time period given to us was from 1930 up to the present. And I know you didn't really come on board at Concordia until midway there or more. But perhaps you know something about early activities theatrical presentations at Concordia. Can you recall?
Well, so far as I know, theater has always been a part of the social scene at Concordia anyway. And I would have expected that a college which was founded as a sectarian school would give inordinate attention to plays with religious kinds of content. And a couple summers ago, I did a retrospective production list of everything that we'd done at our place. And I think I found maybe two productions that could be called religious drama. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was straightforward combination of what good contemporary plays are being written, I guess modern, 10, 15 years old maybe, and the classics. Twelfth Night has been performed at Concordia more than any other play, I think. And As You Like It and Taming the Shrew several times. So, almost from the first year, if not literally the first year, there's been solid attention to the classical literature. At the same time, there ran with that a strain of, it seems to me, let's do a play, The activity-oriented, it's fun to do a play. And so a lot of titles showed up that...
And maybe sponsored by a society of some sort rather than by a department or academic part of a program.
Yeah. I can get to that, but actually until Don Spencer came to Concordia, all the theater at Concordia was sponsored as an activity by a student organization, one or another. But what I meant is plays that were... pot boilers, the kind of things that high schools might be doing. That easy farces by authors that no one remembers. It's fun to do it and put it on, and the audience comes and recognizes their friends in the play, and everybody has a good laugh, and then it's over. That's not what I think theater's for. I expect more of it. But there were these two strains working, and the same people were doing both kinds of plays. After a while, Concordia joined a national dramatic honorary society. Now, I'm not so sure exactly when it is. I think it was about 1928. It was Alpha Psi Omega. And Concordia has the Alpha Alpha cast, which
my
means...
My goodness, that's the beginning of the beginning.
Just about. I suppose Alpha cast was the first one. So at the point where they started going through the Greek alphabet the second time,
yeah.
You know, that,
okay.
That's when we joined in.
All right.
So that organization became the governing body for something called mm-hmm. Concordia Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And Concordia Theater was a student organization that produced plays. It was a club theater. And I've discovered since then that just fits in the pattern of what was being done at colleges and universities all over the United States and in Europe, not in universities, but is part of the independent theater movement. People who believed in theater, interested in theater, would get together and sponsor the production of plays. And the way they underwrote it was to buy season tickets. There was a time that you could not act in a play at Concordia or hammer nails into the scenery unless you were a member of Concordia Theater, and you became a member by buying a season ticket at the beginning of the year.
Well.
And that provided the working capital, and theoretically, then gate receipts. More than one theater is foundered on that dream. Gate receipts were to provide the rest of the money in order to maintain the program. At the point where I came in, was really the end of those days at Concordia. In my sophomore year, a man came whose name is Donald Spencer. I referred to him several times, who was a new master's out of Wisconsin, had been teaching in north central Minnesota in the Bemidji area, and was determined to do something significant in theater. And he did. And one of the results was a splitting away between the people who had the activity interest and people who had a more rigorous, professional or academic, or that kind of a rigorous interest in theater.
So at that time, it became part of the academic
yeah.
department of speech or whatever
fact,
the department was named.
In fact, I was the last presiding treasurer of
the society.
Theater. Yeah,
I
and
see.
I personally brought the books over to the business office.
Good. All right. Well.
And there was some trauma in that because I think one of the things we lost was the initiative that rested with the students.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a trade-off there. So long as it's the amateurs that are running the operation, you've got that kind of team spirit. But you also are limited to the expertise of the beginners. No one's going to have more than 4 years' experience. And we traded off at that point. It was the proper thing to do. But since then, we've been at a loss sometimes, and we've been having to work very hard in order to maintain the kind of interest and support that used to come from the grassroots.
Sure. I remember when Donald Spencer
yeah.
came in for his initial interview.
Oh.
I was teaching part-time in the speech department at that
time. I've heard a number of stories about that.
Well, there was a tornado, I think. Close
yes.
to a tornado on
yes,
the day he came.
And if there hadn't been, he would have caused one, I think.
Maybe. But I thought, you know, he'll never come back. Who would choose to live in this place where geranium tops were blowing away, and it was in the spring, I think. People had just planted a few isolated little flowers, and we literally blew off the map. But he was not...
Well, Joe Knutson told me a little bit about that, Joe said he was unimpressed with the area and with the college and with Joe Knutson, and he left and then thought better of it later on, decided it might be a good place to stay. It was lucky for Concordia that he did, because he brought a kind of an influence that was necessary for us at that stage in our growth. He's not in educational theater. He's not in theater anymore.
Oh, he's not?
No. He had one other theater job after he left Concordia and then left theater. But I think his tendency to be discontented with where he was made him such an innovator of new things. Mm-hmm. And now the new thing he innovated was a conscientious production of The Rivals by Sheridan, an 18th century play, and I had all that new. But to do it in such a workmanlike way, to all of a sudden uncover new, higher standards of achievement than anyone around our place had ever mm-hmm. thought of. That was impressive. You were talking about interviewing stories. Another one that I should add to that, a friend of Don Spencer's came to work at our place a couple years later, Scott Beach, A. Scott Beach. He always thought it was a great injustice because he figured he was the Scott Beach. he taught at Concordia maybe 3 years, and when he interviewed, they put him up at what was then the Frederick Martin Hotel, the FM.
Yes.
Now the Midland Federal Building. And he had a room, well, all the rooms vibrated when
the
trains
went
through. Yeah, that's the NP on that side. And in the morning, the desk clerk had reported to somebody from the college he had come by to check out, and said, can you tell me what time this hotel gets into the station? Because he'd been hearing trains all night long.
Good question. I remember Scott Beach playing Uncle Vanya.
Yes.
And it was a wonderful production.
He also did an Algernon
The Importance of Being
Importance
Earnest.
Of Being Earnest, of course.
Yes.
He was a kind of an Algernon. He played Ostrov, actually. I did Vanya.
Oh, you did Vanya.
I did
Excuse
Vanya.
Me, Al. I remember the production, but I don't remember the cast. It was a wonderful production, I remember, and Chekhov is not easy to do.
No. I've tried to do Chekhov myself, and Chekhov is not easy to do.
Well, not for college students. It calls for some...
Yeah.
Maturity, I think.
Yes.
That college students, you know, have trouble finding.
I think it's the maturity be hard to understand Chekhov. The characters are all, you know, what, 45 going on 16 or something.
Yes, yes.
The characters, I think, by and large, are emotionally very young, but it's hard for someone whose emotional age corresponds that to understand the phenomenon. And I think to play Chekhov, one needs more age.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? It said about Juliet too. By the time an actress is mature enough to understand Juliet, she's too mature
old
to be convincing in the role. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, going back to Scott Beach, yeah. I have heard him commenting for I think the San Francisco Opera. And what did you say he's doing
today?
Well,
I understand that he is the principal drama critic for the San Francisco Examiner. He also has a talk show. It was the first call-in radio show in the San Francisco Bay Area. Every once in a while, somebody sends a newspaper supplement with a story about Scott in it. And once in a while, he'll phone, usually Ralph Hoppe, to ask about things at Concordia. Mm-hmm. And he remembers you, Kathy, and me, and Walt Prausnitz, and a few of the old-timers, and he wonders how we are, you know, and
well,
do we still remember Scott? He also is one of the founders of the Committee, which was an improvisational theater group in San Francisco, similar to the Second City Company in Chicago. The Committee actually did a New York production. Scott wasn't part of them at that point. In fact, when Ralph Hoppe, who has also taught at Concordia for a million years, man and boy have been there a long time, was in San Francisco and went to the club where the Committee was mm-hmm. performing, and Scott spotted him and recognized him in the house.
That's wonderful.
And then in the middle of the improvisation, burst out into singing Soli Deo Gloria.
Oh, my word!
the alma mater for Concordia.
What an experience for Ralph Hoppe. Goodness.
Well, yes.
You know.
And I think about that tightly bonded group that Scott was part of, and mm-hmm. Don, and mm-hmm. the students. Uh, David Lohman, who got a letter of commendation from the governor of North Dakota for being such a good Teddy Roosevelt in the first Medora.
The first Medora production.
He did Teddy Roosevelt. And David married another Concordia Theater person. And the two of them very quickly had a young David. And then went to Pongo Pongo, where he assisted in the English language instruction program.
Goodness.
Janice, his wife, said how nice it is little David and David can come of age together in Samoa. and David went from there to Panama and then died young.
Oh.
It was a good group and a close group. And odd people. Theater attracts odd people.
It sounds like a nucleus of people who really gave birth, in a way, to the program that exists probably today. And when you have a strong heritage to reach back toward, in that case, I think that's strong support for the development of a program. Which, when Don Spencer came, probably it was the first time that courses in theater were offered as part of, for academic credit.
No, there had been courses, the usual, an acting course and a play production course. And that may have been all. But the curriculum was expanded. And that's moved to a point where just now we now have a major in theater. And that's been a long time of mourning.
Well, I'm sure.
30
right.
years.
Yes. Well, is there some particular educational philosophy or theater philosophy that governs the program that could be described?
Two things I think are important. One is that we're an educational theater in several respects. I think, first of all, we're educational for our audience. Now that could sound awfully stuffy, that we're here to improve your minds, and that's not the point at all. But we feel that in exchange for the time and small money investment to come to see the play, we have to try to provide some kind of growth, provide an experience in the theater like life enough to produce spiritual and intellectual and emotional growth. And if we've done that, then we've satisfied our educational function. So in a sense, I suppose, any production of a play is a microcosm of the whole liberal arts objective. So that's part of what we do. And I think different people in the theater, people I work with, have worked with, people that have been there before, I have maybe different ideas as to what constitutes a proper sort of educational experience for the audience. But still, the commitment to that experience is there. In other words, it never has been just, let's do a play because it's so much fun to do plays, or let's earn a few bucks so that we can do this with it, or I love the curtain call and the applause. The mood around the place, which is deeper than a policy, it's like a constitutional provision in Britain, which is more important than anything you can write down in paper. That's part of what we do. Another thing has been a commitment to originality. Sometimes we have done things our way and been less polished than it would have been if we had done a faithful replication of a production that had been done someplace else. But that's a commitment to the innovation idea, to try new things.
Well, the existence of a good studio theater space has made it possible for you to be a lot more experimental, has it not?
Yes, and there was a time when our main productions, by and large, were experiments of one sort or another. Now, marketplace realities are such that that's a little risky now. There are certain kinds of audience expectations in the area, and we have become more and more conservative in the kind of thing that we attempt. But in recognizing that, And we want to take, starting next year, in fact, we want to take particular advantage of that experimental space that we have in our theater building, the room that we call Lab 300, because on the architect's plan it's called 300. It's our laboratory, or the place to experiment, and we plan to institute the first year of an ongoing series in which there will be a major production done experimentally that will be allowed to run long enough so that it can build an audience. The trouble with something done experimentally is at first it merely looks weird, but after word of mouth goes around and people have learned what to expect from it, then it develops an audience. So that's one commitment we have. Perhaps a reinterpretation of a classical play, or a production of a play that's so problematic that it's thought to be unproducible, or new writing. Mm-hmm. Or experimenting with new modes of staging, or mixed dramatic media, or something like mm-hmm. that. In connection with that, also some workshops, possibly a playwriting workshop. We want to start an annual playwriting competition to invite new scripts. So we're on the edge of implementing this,
yes.
this idea.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah. When was the new theater?
1969.
Not so new.
Right.
It was constructed and opened for use in that.
It was delivered in 1969.
Uh-huh.
And this summer, we're finishing it, finally.
Oh.
the last of the deduct alternates that were in it that we needed to add, which is the improvements in the lighting mm-hmm. equipment, is mm-hmm. being finished. Now, what is that? This is 15 or 16 years.
15 or 16 years.
Yeah, well, I still think of it as a new theater. Before that, we were in the building called Old Main, in the room that was built as a chapel and recital hall mm-hmm. and theater, and that had gone through several mm-hmm. stages of remodeling.
Well, this has greatly increased your technical ability in staging to have a new facility, and also seating capacity for your audience.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Yes,
and intimate. Theater.
Much, much more comfortable for the audience than anything we had before.
Yes.
Once in a while, one patron in particular announced to me one day he was never going to come back to our theater so long as we were in Old Main. It had been a hot day. He'd taken off his coat, and his shirt had stuck to the varnish in the seats.
Uh-oh.
And when he came away with some varnish on his shirt.
Uh-oh.
He was angry.
Yes.
Our facilities have provided some kind of technical opportunities. And I think that's been a striking kind of growth we've had in what we've been able to do in technical theater. A couple people occur to me who have been responsible for that. And one is Robert and Julia Dunton,
mm-hmm.
who are off in New Hampshire now.
Uh-huh.
Bob is restoring 18th century houses.
My.
But when he was with us, he was a technical director. And had a grasp of some kinds of theater techniques that were mind-boggling, just exciting, innovative ideas he had for the use of materials. And two other people who are still with us, James Cermak, who's our managing director now, and Helen Cermak, who's Jim's wife, who is another director on our staff and supervises our wardrobe. These people, in addition to other talents, I think mm-hmm. are administrative geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim is an equity stage manager, card-carrying stage manager. He is skilled and one of the best people I know about organizing production details. And that's given us mm-hmm. a strength that's necessitated by having the building that you mentioned.
Yes.
And then certain kinds of growth in our program have mm-hmm. been possible.
I think audiences today expect a technical production at a higher level,
yes.
perhaps, than audiences did 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And so that becomes a built-in part, strain on your budget, I think a big expectation of a college theater.
Yeah. The growth pattern for academic theaters, by and large, were first they hired directors, and then the director started a program, and then hired a technical director, and then the new theater facilities came in after the technical directors, and then growth beyond that in audience development, front of house management, marketing, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. arts management people. And that's been the development phase in the educational theater. And as I look at what we've done, that's been the progression at our place as well. Mm-hmm. And this has given regional audiences a much, much better quality theater than they've ever had in this country, I think. I think the college and universities are responsible for providing theater throughout the United States. The professional theater can't do that because it needs the subsidy which educational institutions provide in one way or another. In Morehead State, it's Student Activity Fund. At our place, it's an academic budget, whatever, one place or another. But it needs the subsidy to survive. And one result of the growth in the educational theater has been educating the audience expectations to expect better theater. That's healthy. That's good, too.
Well, I have some favorite productions over the years, such as...
Candida.
No, I wasn't thinking. That goes back almost prehistory, although I think the Guthrie Theater is producing Candida as part of this year's upcoming season. So I'd like to go back and see
maybe
that
we should
again.
Put together a party and go to it.
We should. We definitely should. But I'm thinking in terms of more recent productions and some of yours. Indians by Arthur Cobbett.
Oh, that was an amazing production. Mm-hmm. We started rehearsal for that when we were doing, in the three colleges, when we were calling Indian Emphasis Week.
Yes.
And we had Dennis Banks and Vine Deloria and a whole lot of people. And I was going into tryouts with Indians, a play which I knew had a record of drawing American Indian Movement protests. Any production that had been done in our area had been picketed by AIM. The woman who on our campus was our minority students'
advisor.
Specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A Native American herself and a member of AIM did some advanced party work for me, and I told her when I was planning the production and asked for her help, and she ran interference for me, and we weren't picketed or anything like that. We also got the cooperation of people in the Indian community in Fargo Moorhead in a way that I think helped the production. And something else that was it's something that affected me personally very, very deeply. We were in the last stage, the casting stage, in which you invite people to come back and find out what roles they're going to play. And at that point, about a dozen or 15 Native American men showed up saying that they were there to try out.
Oh.
Well, some of them were Concordia students who hadn't tried out earlier, but had been pressured by my friend, the AIM member, to try out. So there they were. And the rest of them, they were there actually to provide some moral support. It's an intimidating thing to be crashing into what is clearly an Anglo activity. Mm-hmm. You know, the theater is not an Indian kind of
tradition.
Institution.
No.
And then have to do things that would run against their culture patterns in so many ways. Well, there was a confrontation. The rehearsal ground was stopped. I split them into small groups, and we talked openly about fears. Ended up casting one of the people who tried out as John Grass, one of the principal male roles. Then when we were in rehearsal, I had cast a white student as Sitting Bull. And Sitting Bull is an important man in Native American history, all of American history, but particularly to Native Americans. So this guy was being conscientious in developing the part, and when there was an AIM powwow in St. Paul, the Indians on our campus offered to take him along so he could be around some Indians. And they thought this is very funny. He was their tame white person, and they brought him
kind
along.
Kind of a role reversal.
Yeah, right.
Situation.
His token Anglo.
Yes.
And they brought him along, and while he was there, he was confronted by Eddie Benton, who's a Native American Ojibwe medicine man, AIM member, he's from Wisconsin, and asked him, what do you think would give you the right to play Sitting Bull? And he asked him that several times during the evening, and what Brad concluded is that what Benton meant was, what do you need to do to earn the right?
Oh.
That night he was warned by some friends, if he had someplace else to stay in St. Paul, he should stay there tonight, because someone else had announced they were going to kill him. Well, anyway, We got our production on.
Yeah. I didn't know all this was going on in the background.
Idiots from the community were sewing costumes and doing beadwork for us. On one night, we had one or two extra people in the community who just popped in for a crowd scene. And in the last performance, when the actor, Ken Bordner, who was a faculty member playing Buffalo Bill, when he went around to shake hands as part of the mm-hmm. business with all the Indians near the end, they gave him the Brotherhood Handshake, the AIM Brotherhood oh. Handshake. And that was moving.
Well, what a tribute.
Yeah.
What a tribute. Was the objection of AIM to the fact that white Lutheran students were going to be playing Indian roles, or was there a basic philosophic difference about the text of the play?
No, I think the objection was when the play had been done originally by Arthur Coppett, he had not consulted with Native Americans.
I see.
And that whenever it had been produced, they had not taken Native Americans into account.
Okay.
And so
all
this
right.
was, once again, the white community giving their interpretation
yeah.
of what noble
I
savages
see.
Were.
Yes, I see.
And when we
Even
decided,
though it seemed on the surface to us who saw it as very sympathetic to
yes.
the Indian movement, it brought things to my attention. For example, the effect of the white missionary movement, the devastating effect of that on Indian communities. I guess I hadn't really thought of that before. So I would have thought AIM would have supported what would be interpreted by the play. But I see, you know, their point of being left out.
Yes, and I think they also found it patronizing that
okay.
we in the white community were going to do this nice thing
yes,
for the Indians.
Yes, I understand. Now, how complex that is, but what I bet you didn't realize you had launched something nearly that controversial when you decided to do the play.
I had a glimpse of it when we were getting
mm-hmm.
it ready,
mm-hmm.
and there were all kinds of we had repercussions of all sorts. There mm-hmm. there were protests about language in the play, and there was a space where it looked like I might be fired and the theater closed down.
Oh, my word.
So that was a memorable production in a lot
I'm
of ways.
Sure.
But I think you
well,
see...
I'm glad I brought it up.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. But I think that kind of I don't know, conflict and turmoil, all those goings-on underneath provide a kind of energy mm-hmm. and life.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the point, I think, that dramatic art is not something that you rehearse and you do slickly, maybe in the same way that you make a car.
Right.
It is art because it comes out of what you care about and where you hurt and where
mm-hmm.
you feel good.
Right. Well, another one. Maybe I shouldn't go on with these controversial scripts.
I'll try to come up with shorter responses for the others.
The Caucasian Chalk Circle is a marvelous Brecht play, and you did a beautiful production of
that. That was the first production that I worked with Helen and Jim Cermak on.
Uh-huh.
And in some ways, it's probably the best thing we've ever done together. I remember that. I remember a moment at the end when, well, the story of the play is that a young woman, just out of her spontaneous sense of decency, she's not a bleeding heart liberal or anything like that, she picks up a baby that's been abandoned and takes care of it at considerable cost to her. Well, it turns out that this baby that's been abandoned is the son of some rich people who've been overturned in a revolution. When at the end of the play, the mother is back in power again and decides she wants the baby back, Grusha, the good servant girl, says, no, we've been through some things. You know, we live together, die together. This is my mm-hmm. baby. And so a judge decides whose baby it is. And that's mm-hmm. the same as the Solomon
yeah.
story with the baby in the
right.
circle. But at the end of that, there's a moment in which all the characters get together and dance, and Grusha and the little boy dance together, and it's the kind of thing that can happen in the theater. Life does not end so neatly paired off in dancing, but the audience loved it, and I did too.
Yeah.
And just sensing the audience response in the rightness of justice and mothers and children being brought together and the bad guys sent off and
right.
foiled and the whole thing.
Well, I've used an argument that I always thought came from that play. You know, he who farms the land should own the land.
Yes.
And my own interpretation is, you know, she who cleans the house, you know, lives in the house or the cabin or whatever structure is
yeah.
really the primary
yeah.
owner, since that person is caretaker. But Brecht's Epic Theater has been a major theater influence in this century, and I think these productions seem experimental perhaps to audiences, but have a profound effect that maybe aren't realized. And that's an ambitious thing to take on.
That had a particular meaning for me and for us locally, because we had just recently, in a year or so, adopted a black son.
Yes.
And so who's his real mother?
That's
questions
right,
came up.
Of course.
And so then you end up with, well, what is it, you know, and to be the owner of the land, or who is the real mother? And the answer you quoted is Brecht's answer. I saw another production of this in Glasgow. I've been greatly influenced by the Glasgow Citizens Theatre Company, a marvelous organization. I've tried to find out as much about them as I can. I've gotten to know several people in the company. And I was there for production of Caucasian's Chalk Circle, which Giles Havergal directed. And one of the ideas he had in there was to question the wisdom, this conclusion on ownership. And that production leaves you with a question, should a person own the land simply because that person can make it prosper? He said, should the Gaza Strip be owned and controlled by the latest inhabitants of that land who have pushed off the Palestinians mm-hmm. through there before, simply because they can make it produce more grapes than the previous mm-hmm. owners? And so he took my thinking a stage further and went back to what I think is maybe a more faithful Brechtian ending that leaves you with a dialectic wondering, what is the real solution, mm-hmm. instead of saying, oh,
and is
yeah,
there an absolute answer
that's right.
to these questions?
Yeah, and as you say, Brecht's influence in the theater has been in part that he forces the dialectic, he forces the argument mm-hmm. Without allowing the easy solution. Mm-hmm. That makes him a provocative writer. It makes him a risky one to produce. Audiences are going to be annoyed with him, because audiences, by and large, me too, when I'm in the audience, I like the answer at the end.
Well, true. We like a resolution,
yeah.
probably. Well, a favorite year at Concordia for me was the year of, was it an Ibsen, bicentennial, when Dr. Mm-hmm. Einarhaugen came mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. do the lectures, and I think you did a production of The Wild Duck.
Yes.
Which was another
yeah.
very successful and
I've had good luck with Ibsen.
Mm-hmm.
I find things I understand about Ibsen. There's a man named Rolf Fjeldi, whose father was educated in Mayville, teachers, who is related to the Wrights, who live in Fargo and Moorhead.
Oh.
Rolf Fjeldi's father was a sculptor and had sculpted had sculpted Ibsen from life mm-hmm. in a bust. We have a plaster of it at Concordia. There's a bronze of that in the park at Wahpeton, in Jehinkopa Park.
Oh, for heaven's
and then in Loring Park in the Twin Cities. And then there's another bronze of that in Sheehan that was just made in the last 10 years in a new Ibsen park that they've put up in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rolf Fjeldi translates Ibsen plays. I think the best translations available are ones that Fjeldi has done. And we've had some contact with him. I like to do his translations. And the key to success with Ibsen, I think, is the key to Rolf's translations, is that his characters speak English the way Norwegian Americans speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And the idiom, the personality seems familiar in a way that it doesn't strike me as familiar when I'm reading an English translation. Then the characters seem English. But that production of Wild Duck you talked about, I think, was successful in the sense that the characters were, mm-hmm. were real human beings.
Well, it's also one of Ibsen's very best plays.
Yeah.
But it's a difficult thing to produce and to do well. But I think your students achieved an understanding and sensitivity to all of.
I lit a production of Wild Duck once when I was a student, and with our limited equipment, I tried to duplicate as faithfully as I could, literally, the effects that Ibsen called for in the stage directions,
mm-hmm.
and That was one of the times when I got mentioned in a review for a production device, and simply because, although the reviewer didn't know it, it had been what Ibsen had intended. I think that's another thing about Ibsen. He understands what works on stage so mm-hmm. well. I say understands. Isn't it funny about these long-dead people whose work is still so important?
Oh, yes.
You know,
yes.
Their ghost is around.
Mm-hmm.
But Ibsen's understanding of what works with audiences, and not just Norwegian audiences, not just European or probably Western audiences even, was so accurate. And his understanding of the stage technology, and mm-hmm. and when a long speech is called for, and when a short one, and when polysyllabic words are needed, and when they have to be simple, ordinary words, very bright man. And whether he did that because he consciously knew it, or whether he sensed it, I guess doesn't make much difference. But he did it, and he did it consistently again
yes,
and again and again.
Yes, right, and left a marvelous body of work.
Yes, and of course himself an experimentalist. You see, I didn't realize that when I got hooked on Ibsen as mm-hmm. a student, but his play Ghosts started the independent theater movement all around. It was the first important production of the Freie Bühne in Berlin, the German free theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first production of J.T. Grein's independent theater in London.
Was it because of the text?
I think so.
The subject matter.
Right. And the Théâtre Libre in Paris by mm-hmm. Antoine, that was also mm-hmm. the first production, Ghosts. And I think it was partly the text of the play. It was a controversial play.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also the personality of Ibsen in that he himself was always on the frontier of what he did. In fact, he alienated supporters just with about every new play he wrote
mm-hmm.
because they said, oh, this is our Ibsen. Now he's mm-hmm. fostering our cause, but then he would go on to something else.
Right. Well, he did finally leave Norway and live in exile, didn't he?
Well, he did that early on.
Early.
Yeah, he was better treated outside of Norway uh-huh. and maybe the climate was better, certainly in Rome mm-hmm. than in...
Well, yes, we can all understand that. Yeah.
There were other things about right. Ibsen that were not admirable, but his
right.
his ability... To keep on moving on to things that are new. And then he quit writing when he ran out of new things to write. He didn't get stuck into something that had worked before.
Mm-hmm.
In the theater, there's something you know about called second night slump. And if you have a strong first production, you know, first night, then there's a great tendency to try to duplicate the good things that you did before.
Mm-hmm.
And if you try to do that, then it's stale and flat and it lacks spirit. You have to do it as though for the first time. And I think that's true of creativity in general. It needs the innovative spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are productions are part of the past. Is there something in the more recent past that has been a particularly fond memory for you?
Well, I did a Brecht recently. I did Three Penny Opera.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty exciting because it was the first musical theater I'd done in a while, and it was fun to get back to stating ideas with music. And I did As You Like It just this year,
mm-hmm.
and with these productions, I've been doing things that were consciously more pictorial and visual than I'd tried before. I've always been interested in the text, the way I was educated.
Yes.
And literary values and ideas and dialogue. And I still think they're as important as I always did. But I feel a little stronger, a little bit better at providing visual kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
We played As You Like It on a rake, a sloped stage,
mm-hmm.
and had a croquet match in the...
On a slope stage?
On the second stage. That required square croquet balls. They were not an unmixed success, technically, but they looked a treat.
That's innovative, Claire.
It is. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Right.
I think the trick was for the actresses to hit them just hard enough. If they didn't hit them hard enough, they didn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They hit them too hard, they went out into the audience, and a 3.5 inch square maple cube with edges is a dangerous missile when sent at deaf old ladies in the back room.
Right. Goodness. Well, how about plans for the future?
I talked a little bit about the experimental theater idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about as an exciting thing as I run into. I've hit a point in my life when I feel gathering for another leap forward, and I have something else to do, and you know, doing something new, and for me to make my major effort an experimental production of some sort or another, with the idea that it's going to be part of what I do for a future, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've been looking at, and I've been doing this for several years, and it's going slow because it needed a lot of rewriting. I found out some things about Eastern Orthodox religion and what an icon is. You know, icon is a window through which you see reality. Well, that's very much like what an actor is or what a play is, too. But I've also become interested in the Greek literature, particularly the character of Oedipus and the character of Creon, and to see that Oedipus, you know, ended as a kind of a saint. You know, Elijah went off in the fiery chariot, and Oedipus vanished into, who knows, an earthquake or something. But he became a hero of the sort that Hercules was for the Greeks, and was worshipped. So to blend the notions that Eastern Orthodoxy have about what sainthood is, and I think they have a clearer understanding than those of us in the Western Roman tradition have, and the mysticism, a production that would involve choral odes which sound like Orthodox chanting, and a setting which combines features of an iconostasis and a theater facade. The iconostasis in a Greek church has three doors. Well, so did the skena on the Greek stage.
Mm-hmm.
There are some interesting possibilities to view Oedipus as an icon of what it is to be a human being, the best that one can be as a human being, the most complete, and that includes his shocking, repellent, you know, sin, is having fathered children by his mother, and that this repulsive person goes off in glory. That's mm-hmm. that's about as theatrical as you can get.
Right.
So that's the big project that's been the back of my mind, and I've got to find the time to do it.
Something almost cosmic in proportion.
I think it is.
And reminds me of an earlier production of a Greek drama. Can't remember the name of it.
Prometheus Bound.
Prometheus Bound,
yeah.
Which you had to produce an earthquake, I believe,
yes.
on stage, which was no small accomplishment.
The man who played Prometheus and who also engineered the earthquake had been Hjalmar Ekdal in that production of Wild Duck that you talked about.
Oh, I see.
He's off finishing up a combination speech theater PhD at Carbondale. Hardly anyone does those anymore,
uh-huh.
you know.
No.
He's a genius.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that he provided for that production. We used film in order to protract the... Mm-hmm. We used slow motion film of the earthquake, and we used all kinds of mm-hmm. fog and mm-hmm. and a rock that vanished down into the abyss and light. And that was
an ambitious.
It was exhausting.
I'm sure. I think another student from that era, whose name I run into occasionally, is Rolf Olson.
Yeah.
Who is coaching theater and teaching theater in Eden Prairie.
Yes.
And he's going to be serving as one of the panelists for operating support for the State Arts Board this year. So.
Really, he's been on the Guthrie Literary Advisement
mm-hmm.
Board as
good.
Well.
Good.
Yes, and Rolf did a number of things at Concordia when he was here.
Yes.
I think it was Rolf that played Gregor Zverla in that production of Wild
Duck.
I think so.
Right. Well, I think our time is running short here, but the Concordia Theater Program has been a really core program in cultural opportunities and development in this community.
One thing we didn't talk about that probably should be mentioned, I think Concordia did the first summer theater ever done in this community. That was Don Spencer's innovation, and you were in on it.
Yes.
It was My Three Angels, your production.
Right. And Candida. Those were my two plays.
Yes. And Edward Pixley, who was in that cast, is now the principal author-editor for the latest revision of George Crinodle's book on Introduction to the Theater.
That's interesting. Yeah. Wonderful.
That was an interesting bunch of people.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Well, that was perhaps the first summer theater project in this community. Had there been anything?
No, there'd never been anything else.
Mm-hmm. And we did produce four plays
in
that
eight
summer.
Weeks.
And even went on tour. Do you remember? You all went down to Detroit Lakes.
Yes, we lost $10 on that production.
I don't remember the financial transactions.
But we came by pretty well, I think. We moved it in Doug Siller's grain truck.
I see.
And we kept stopping because the sediment bowl kept filling up with sediment. I think there was grain in the tank. There goes that innovation thing again. George Crinodle is a theater scholar who is not in the mainstream. He's written a book called From Art to Theater, which was his PhD dissertation at the University of Chicago. No one believes it, but no one can take it for granted. So anyone who writes anything about the theater, somewhere along the line, has to refute George Crinodle.
I see.
He has taken the same evidence that everybody else consults, and he has come up with strikingly different, well-argued conclusions. And I think that's interesting that Ed Pixley, who is a product of that same milieu that I talk about, has gotten attached to George and Portia Crinodle, somebody else who's on the cutting edge and still is.
Right.
That's
I'm very interested in hearing that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, do you think there's any... This is a bare beginning and scratching of the surface, certainly, of the history of a program that spans so many years. But we're trying to hit the high points. And do you think there's some other
Some other thing
idea
that could be added. There was an organization at Concordia for some time called Student Productions. Mm-hmm. That was started by a number of people, Ron Moan and Robert Dryden, who now is at Brainerd Junior Community College. Bob Dryden is. They did the first musical theater productions that were on a continuing basis. I mean, Blue Key at NDSU also was doing them, starting at about the same time. Mm-hmm. Mammoth kinds of things were done in the field house. Thousands of people, technical problems that never could be solved. Some of the student interest and initiative that I talked about as having founded Alpha Psi Omega way back when, 1928 and before that, that same spirit had gone into the Student Productions Organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that I think could be commented on is the cooperation between the theater department and the music department in the production of the annual Christmas concert, which is such a hallmark for Concordia College.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember telling students, you know, that the musical performance had to borrow a lot of elements from drama to keep it visually appealing. The lighting, the scenery, the movement. There are lots of dramatic elements in that presentation that made it very successful. And I know that Jim Cermak of late has been instrumental in technical production.
As a manager, the thing could never move to Minneapolis and get set up without Jim's kind of organizational ability.
Mm-hmm.
That started in about 1956. Don Spencer and I had just finished, you know, a day or so before, wiring together a lighting control board, and we heard from somebody in maintenance that they were having trouble setting up something for the Christmas concert. So the two of us pushed down the light board down the sidewalk to the field house and said, "We're here to help." And we hung the lights, and the theater has been doing lighting for the Christmas concert almost continuously. The theater and the music department have gotten along, not perfectly, that's impossible, but better than I've ever heard of any place at Concordia. There's been such kind of cooperation and supportiveness. We did the first production of Three Penny Opera we did in the summer. It was hard to scrape a band together in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob, you know, pulled out his trumpet.
And, oh.
And he played, not first trumpet, second trumpet. We had a first trumpeter already. And that's the kind
that's
of...
That's wonderful, yeah, you know, to have that kind of support. And, yeah.
And Bob Hansen has been somebody that we'd phone and say help to, and he would help us. And lots of other people are on there, too.
Well, I remember you've commissioned some original music. You've had some wonderful music integration in many of your performances.
I had an exchange last summer with Arnie Running about that, who was a high school student, and we'd had a new clarinet music written for a production of Thieves' Carnival. Mm-hmm. And he was his high school senior that summer, and had played the clarinet. And I found the score. Roger Hannay had composed and sent that off to him. He's interested in doing something with that since then. Yeah, that reminds me of all kinds of things.
Yes.
Opera productions that were done.
Yeah. Well, I hope somebody will write a history. You've compiled at least a list of all the productions. Now, if you could fill in the cracks and provide a history.
Well, if I buy my word processor this summer, then I'll
then
give
you'll be better
it.
Prepared. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Claire Haugen from Concordia College, for participating in this oral history project for the Heritage Education Commission.
Thank you.